And you're listening to Unusual Sources here on 93.3 CFMU-FM, broadcasting to Hamilton at 93.3 on the FM dial, and the rest of the world at cfmu.mcmaster.ca, our online streaming service. It's the first show of the season, and today's special guest is Eve Engler, Canadian author and journalist who's extremely prolific, and he has been featured in quite a number of interviews on this program. Eve, are you here with us today?
How's it going?
Good, good. I'm glad to hear from you, and you're coming in loud and clear. And I mean, Eve, you're touring Canada again for another book launch. You know, I'm just wondering. I mean, what? How many books have you written now?
Eight books.
Eight books. Wow, that's. Last time, I guess it would have been seven Eves, like that book that came out the other year. You know, the thing is, I used to say that Eve Engler was a walking printing press or walking publishing press, having contributed and created so many works here. But really, it's now you're basically a walking library, you know. Because if you want to look up, you know, Haiti or Canada's relationship with Israel or something, you just take a book from Eve Engler, basically, and, you know, he's covered so much in terms of Canada's foreign policy and his real role in the world. And I think a continuing theme we see here is that, you know, Canada is not such a benevolent actor. It's not the nice guy that it portrays itself to be. It's in for itself. It's tagging along the United States, and it's involved heavily in exploitation. And, of course, that's a feature of your new book. This one's about Africa. What's it called?
Canada in Africa, 300 Years of Aid and Exploitation.
300 Years of Aid and Exploitation. Now, where can people get that book?
Well, the book's actually won't be out for a couple weeks, once it's out, it should be available at all the independent bookstores and online and the different e-books, and there will be a launch in Hamilton in a couple weeks.
Of course, that is the 19th. Toronto is on the 20th, I believe. That's so Eve is personally accompanying his book, and he'll be able to answer questions, sign books, and things like that. And we're very glad about that. This may be one of the most important books about Africa ever written in Canada. And if it's anything like Eve's other books, it's going to set the tone of activism, and it's going to be a very important cornerstone of university courses or students who are genuinely looking at Canada's foreign policy beyond the usual buzzwords and jargon speak and corporate nonsense. So it's going to be a very important book, and we're very glad to host it here on the 19th in Hamilton. You're going to be able to find information about that launch. It's already been posted on Facebook at facebook.com/Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War. There's an event posting a page down or so. It will be on the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War website soon enough, but we'll get to that later. But Eve, I mean, we want to talk to you about your book, but we also want to talk to you today in particular because you've written a number of articles that have appeared on the internet. I saw two on Counterpunch in the last week alone. You've been writing a great deal. The focus is on Africa at the moment, and you've had two articles that I've noticed in Counterpunch. One of them was on August 28th. It was called Harper Conservatives and Abuse of Power. It reflects the trend we're seeing where there's a lot of articles in online newspapers like the Taiyi where they talk about Harper's violation of the domestic political process. And you can certainly find a lot of that. Whole books have been written on what this government is doing to Canada. But what the corporate media seems unable or unwilling to tackle is the what you've called a much larger, a more flagrant and far-reaching law-breaking. And that is what Canada is doing abroad, what the Harper government has done in the last few years. And you made specific reference to Libya in the 2011 campaign there. And you focused specifically on Security Council resolutions 1970 and 1973. And then they're important. They're central to the article. So can you refresh us, I guess, what was the purpose of, you know, resolution 1973?
Well, the idea was a ceasefire and a sort of a humanitarian corridor, humanitarian protection. But what I outlined in the article was that the Harper government was in very direct violation of both of the UN resolutions, which is, you know, in direct violation of international law, by the fact that there were Canadian troops in Libya. There were a number of media reports that never confirmed, of course, by the federal government, but that Canadian Special Forces were on the ground, which was in direct violation of the resolution that very explicitly said no foreign troops in the country. And so that's a violation. I mean, at the big picture, lots of people have obviously discussed that what the NATO forces did was they took a resolution that called for a ceasefire and then basically expanded that to justify or claimed that it justified a whole bombing campaign and basically a whole war on the country with the purpose of getting rid of Gaddafi and then basically being the air force of a rebel faction. So that's been discussed a fair bit, but I there hasn't been a whole lot of discussion about just completely explicit violations of the resolution in the case of Canadian troops on the ground. And beyond that, there was also a number of media reports that talked about how the Canadian government got armed rebels with drones, a couple of drones that a Waterloo-based company, Aryan, had an official from that company, a former Canadian military person, who went and trained the rebels on how to use the drone, the small backpack-sized drone for intelligence gathering and the like. And that was also quite explicitly against the resolutions in terms of an arms embargo. There's a number of other that I didn't include in the article, but a number of other ways in which Canadian naval vessels patrolling off the coast when they stopped vessels that were full of arms. This was reported on an Ottawa Citizen. Full of arms destined to the rebels, they let those boats through. And then the final thing in the article that I talk about that also hasn't been reported much is that Garderworld, and I go into this in the book in more detail, which I didn't go into in the article. Garderworld is the biggest Montreal-based private security company. It is the biggest foreign private security company in Libya. There's more than 3,500 Garderworld employees in Libya today, and they said very explicitly on their website that they entered Libya in the summer of 2011. But Gaddafi was not killed, of course, until October 20th of that year. So the UN resolutions also explicitly refer to mercenaries as not being welcome. And there's an academic literature out there that goes into that a decent amount about exactly the definition of what that would be. And almost certainly Garderworld's employees would be defined as their operations would be legally defined as counter to United Nations Resolution 1970-1973. So you have a whole sort of plethora of ways in which the Conservative government and Canadian corporations, working very obviously very closely with the government, were in explicit violation of these UN Security Council resolutions. And so that's a serious example of law breaking by the Harper government that's been almost completely undiscussed. But beyond that, of course, is the consequences to Libya and to Libyans of the NATO backed campaign, and that's another issue that's getting fairly limited. It's well documented in international press, but gets almost no attention in Canada, which is that Libya is in a state of significant upheaval, sectarian war, civil war, and so the toll of Canada's military campaign in Libya on Libyans is something significant that deserves some attention.
I remember the period well in 2011. The news media and humanitarian organizations were screaming, something has to be done, we have to do something. And so the UN, they say, yeah, we're going to have this resolution, and we're going to uphold people's, we're going to protect people, and Canada and the US are talking about safety and law and so on. And here they are violating the UN Security Council resolutions in the name of protecting people and upholding the law. You know, it's incredible, because the violation, as you pointed out, there was boots on the ground, mercenaries, sending of drones, weapons, allowing fighters in, you know, basically policing an arms embargo to let some things in and not other things in, kind of like the Spanish Civil War. You know, it's incredible, because part of that whole song they were giving us was, oh, there's going to be no boots on the ground. No boots on the ground. As if, number one, that's supposed to comfort us. You know, we're going to kill people just from the air. Or we're going to regime change, but don't worry, we're not going to use any troops on the ground. But number two, it was a lie, right? Because they had people on the ground, and you have to have some coordination to send mercenaries and use Ontario-made drones supporting one faction in the country. But yeah, well, they all lived happily ever after, right? I mean, Libya now, just it's all peaceful and happy now, thanks to Harper and Obama. So, you mentioned that the media doesn't talk about it much, and I don't know if you wanted to venture an opinion on this, but why do you think the law breaking on the national or international scale isn't being discussed?
Well, that was part of the article, was actually, you know, the Tai'i is viewed as a sort of left-wing media outlet out in BC, and that was the jumping-off point. They had a whole list of 70 different examples of the Harper government's law breaking. And probably the biggest example of Harper government's law breaking, which was the violation of the UN resolutions with regards to Libya, didn't even make it into the list. And I actually submitted the op-ed, the article, to the Tai'i, thinking that they might want to run it because it sort of was relevant to a campaign that they've sort of been going on about Harper's abuse of power, and the editor there was unwilling to publish the article. So this is viewed as a fairly progressive media. This is not the Hamilton Spectator or CTV or whatever, and still there's this unwillingness to delve into Harper's for the sort of criminality, and I don't mean it at the moral level. I mean direct criminality, like law breaking of Harper's foreign policy. So the bias in the media, in the dominant media, is particularly striking. I've uncovered a whole bunch of examples in the book on Canada's role in Africa, and I go a bit more kind of aggressively or explicitly against the sort of the whole certainly the media realm of refusal to cover foreign policy issues from a critical perspective, but also just the whole outside of just the corporate media, but the academic world and the intellectual environment in this country is of one, particularly on foreign policy, the assumption is always that Canada is trying to do good, that there's an inherent benevolence to Canadian foreign policy, and even if you, in some instances, were willing to criticize specific violations, the reference point is always a return to this inherent goodness and the forces behind that, of course, are that there are major corporations and whole foreign affairs bureaucracy that have a pretty significant self-interest in perpetuating a certain ideology about Canada's role in the world.
Yeah, it feels like there's a gentleman's agreement not to bring attention to what Canada is doing abroad. For those who are just tuning in, we're speaking with Yves Engler, Canadian author and journalist, author of 8 books, most recent book, Canada in Africa, launching here in Hamilton on the 19th of this month, and in Toronto on the 20th, and there will be details about that. You can find some of them at facebook.com/Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War. But Yves, you've been very busy. You also wrote an article very recently, today, is it September 2nd? Yeah, right there in Counterpunch, sort of a very related, I suppose, because of your focus on Africa at the moment. This one is called Canada versus Africa, and it looks at Canada's role in training militaries in Africa. And it seems to be, you've pointed out that there's an extensive training program that has existed for some time. So what's Canada doing with regard to military training in Africa?
Well, today there's significant military training, a whole series of different initiatives and programs that I detail in the book. Millions, tens of millions of dollars of Canadian money going into supporting different training initiatives. Probably some of the more controversial are the Canadian Special Forces that are engaged on the ground, particularly in the Sahel region, in the northern part of sub-Saharan Africa, all framed as counter-terrorism kind of initiatives. They are exercise called Flintlock, which is led by the U.S. Africa Command, and the Canadian training missions across the continent are increasingly aligned with U.S. Africa Command. U.S. Africa Command is a major push by the U.S. military onto the continent over the past decade or so, and it's really about deepening Western military influence, control, if you like, on the continent. Probably, in large part, a response to Chinese economic relations with different African countries, but also, I think, just a recognition of the substantive natural resources across the continent. Obviously, with Canadian mining companies, some of the biggest players. But in the article, I run through some of it's almost always framed as counterterrorism or about drug smuggling or whatnot, that the training initiatives, but the both the history, and even if you look a little deeper on what the Canada's Military Training Assistance Program says about what the objective of these training initiatives is about developing Canadian influence, and how that influence is used is that's the million-dollar question. And the evidence suggests that certainly the historical evidence suggests that it's used very much to advance Western geostrategic interests. And I go through a historical example that's actually quite well documented with internal government files of Canada's role, the Canadian trained military's role in Ghana in overthrowing Kwame Nkrumah, the independence leader in Ghana in 1966, and it was a Canadian-trained military that was training the military after independence, after Ghana had removed British trainers, and the Canadian officials quite openly in their internal communications at the time were trying to build up a Ghanaian military that remained sympathetic to Western interests. This is right after colonialism, of course, and so that Western interest was this was a the military created by Britain, of course. So the Canadian trained military overthrew Nkrumah, and Canadian officials celebrated that coup. And I think that there's little to suggest that the underlying motivations and the underlying effects of Canadian military training in the continent have changed a whole lot in the past five decades. The objective is still to advance Western U.S.-led geostrategic interests, and it's still these training Canadian military training initiatives, I think, are still contrary to the interests of the majority of Africans. But it's a whole area that's completely outside of any sort of discussion. There's actually surprisingly large amounts of details if you take the time to look it up online. But it's not. I mean, it's the topic that is very far from any sort of public discussion, and there should be a public discussion about Canada's military training in Africa and globally, because there's a, particularly on the continent, there's a whole push that it is building as the U.S. Africa Command increases its footprint across the continent. And there's Nick Turse, a U.S. Journalist, has documented this very, very extensively of this growing American military role on the continent. Canadian military officials are following closely along. A number of joint initiatives. Back in 2011, we have the example of the Harper government wanting to set up permanent, what they called support hubs, which are small bases. The plan was to set up one in East Africa and one in West Africa. We haven't heard much about where that has, how that has gone forward. But there is this growing push of the Canadian military on the continent through military training programs, through growing role of the Canadian Naval, Canadian Navy off the coast, and a number of other initiatives that deserve to be looked at and discussed in some sort of historical context.
Yeah, I mean, what you're talking about here, I imagine these are all subsets of some of the larger discussions in your book, Canada in Africa, which of course is launching on the 19th here in Hamilton. You know, I imagine that we've seen some snippets of what your book is going to present. So what are the broad themes that are talked about in your new book? And, you know, what are some of the areas that you look at, like in terms of geographically, what countries are you looking at, or what parts of history are you looking at when you talk about Canada in Haiti with 300 years of exploitation?
Well, I go back to Canada's ties to the transatlantic slave trade. One of the more stark examples was the role of the Atlantic provinces, current day Atlantic provinces, in feeding literally the cod that was sold to the plantation economies down in the Caribbean to the slaves to keep them working. So that goes the history of Canada's ties to the transatlantic slave trade, to Canadians' role in conquering different parts of the continent. Hundreds of Canadians helped primarily the British, but also the Belgians conquer different parts of the continent. So Canadian soldiers, usually trained at the Royal Military College of Canada in Kingston, to a whole section on Canadian missionaries. And there's a couple thousand Canadian missionaries working across the continent by the end of the colonial period. Canadian missionaries, in one instance where they exchanged land for health services to Cecil Rhodes' forces that conquered Zimbabwe. So a Canadian missionary was led up this this agreement with Cecil Rhodes to the colonial period and Canada's complicity in European colonialism across the continent. Canadian officials who were governors of Ghana, northern Nigeria, Kenya, governors, obviously working for the British, but were born and trained in Canada and were celebrated at the time as great Canadians. Today, a whole chapter on Canadian companies involved in privatization across the continent is an Ottawa-based consultancy firm called CPCS Transcom, which I'd never heard of until beginning the research on this, has been involved in over $22 billion in privatization initiatives across the continent, and that's obviously closely aligned with the whole World Bank IMF push to remodel African economies in the interests of the private sector and foreign companies. And Canadian government has been involved in that process, spending tens of millions of dollars in Canadian aid money to push governments, different African governments, to privatize their economies. So it's the book's wide ranging. It touches on primarily sub-Saharan Africa. There's a little bit about North Africa, but primarily sub-Saharan Africa, and it goes through the colonial period right up until today, of course, where the Canadian mining companies, Canada is a mining superpower in Africa, and Canadian mining companies dominate in most countries outside of South Africa. Canadian mining companies are the dominant players, and there's big questions about the direct human rights violations they're involved with on one hand, but also bigger picture of what benefit does the mining sector actually provide to most Africans. And it's really about, or the effect of it is about, is reinforcing dependence across the continent. So the book's wide ranging. It's actually the biggest book that I've done, and I was completely taken aback by how much new information that after having researched Canadian foreign policy for at least a decade now, I was pretty astounded by how much else there is out there that that I was completely ignorant about.
I'm pretty astounded how numerous well-funded academic departments managed to miss all this, as well as our national media and the six or so large corporations that own the news here. So somehow they missed all that, but a lone individual was able to read a whole lot there. Eve's books are extensively documented and are world-renowned. I hope people are paying attention to this, and I hope that this spreads through the university. I know that there's interest in this book launch, both here and in Toronto and in other places, and Eve's books tend to make a wave, and I certainly hope that's the case there, as it is sorely needed, especially in an age when we're told continually that Canada is a force for good in the world, and there's a lot of outstretched hands waiting for our aid to uplift them. And I think Eve provides a necessary counter to that by analyzing what's actually going on economically and militarily. So Eve, thanks very much. I'm very glad that you're coming on the 19th. So we're all looking forward to that. So thanks very much for giving us your time today and for being on the program.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, bye-bye. And that, of course, was Eve Angler. Now, you can find information about the upcoming book launch on the Facebook page for the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War. If you just go to facebook.com/ Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War, and within a day or two or so, there should be the full announcements posted on the website for the Hamilton Coalition to Stop the War at www.hamiltoncoalitiontostoptheWar.ca. This, of course, is part of a national tour, and this is hopefully, as I said, going to make some real waves in the study and discussion of Canada's role in Africa. Eve's work on Haiti was groundbreaking. His work on Canada and Israel was much needed. All of his books have played an important role in political discussion in this country, and we'll be glad to be seeing him not too long from now here in Hamilton. So thanks. We'll be right back.